Welcome to this edition of the speaker series in the Hoover Institution's project on China's global shark power. I am Glenn Tiffert, project manager and a research fellow here at the Hoover Institution. Ordinarily, our gaze focuses on China, but today we bring you something a bit different, an important new paper by Jennifer Pan and Yiqing Xu that redirects the lens back on the United States and invites us to redouble our commitments to our own values. Asian Americans, and in particular persons of Chinese descent, have been a vibrant part of the American story since the founding of our country. At the same time, they have been uniquely vulnerable to the vicissitudes of our foreign policy and foreign relations. The United States has a history of racism and ethnic scapegoating, and the current reevaluation of our relationship to China has given those vile impulses new vigor. Faith in the promise of America can be both a strength and a blind spot. Many have taken it as axiomatic that contact with the United States is an effective way of transmitting our democratic values around the globe. However, the authors show that this may actually be a double-edged sword. The authors find that Chinese overseas students grow more supportive of authoritarian rule when they experience American racism. To the extent that the authors are right, then our failure is twofold, and the lesson seems clear. Challenging China's global shark power demands that we lead by example and model our own competing democratic values at home better. Let's remain ever mindful of that connection. Towards the end of this session, we will open the floor to questions from the audience. I invite you to submit your questions using the Q&A button at the bottom of your screens. But now I'd like to introduce our distinguished guests, each a rising academic star. Jennifer Pan is Assistant Professor of Communication at Stanford University. Her research resides at the intersection of political communication and authoritarian politics, showing how authoritarian governments try to control society, how the public responds, and when and why each is successful. She has done pioneering work on how China manages expression on social media. Her new book, Welfare for Autocrats: How Social Assistance in China Cares for Its Rulers, shows how China's pursuit of political order transformed the country's main social assistance program for repressive purposes. Yiqing Xu is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Stanford University. His primary research covers political methodology, Chinese politics, and their intersection. He received a PhD in political science from MIT and has won many professional awards, including the best article from the American Journal of Political Science in 2016 and the Miller Prize for the best work appearing in political analysis in 2017. With that introduction, I now turn it over to Jennifer Pan. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us today. Since the fall of last year, my co-authors Ying Jiefan, Zijie Shao, and Yiqing, who is here with us, we've been conducting a study of Chinese overseas students in the US. Today, I'm going to focus on the results of one part of that study, which is still ongoing. Educational exchange between the US and the People's Republic of China began in 1978 under Jimmy Carter and Deng Xiaoping. Since 1987, millions of Chinese students have studied in the US. Today, Chinese students represent the largest source of international students in the US, contributing nearly $13 billion to the US economy. However, the presence of Chinese students has also become the subject of political debate, and there are increasing restrictions on students, researchers, and scholars from China. So the motivating question for our project is, what is the experience of overseas Chinese students in the US, and especially with regard to their political values and opinions? And I would say that there's been a lot of speculation about this experience. For example, some have suggested that the view that studying in the US makes students obtain democratic values doesn't hold for Chinese students, that somehow coming to the US makes Chinese students more nationalistic and more likely to reject democratic values. But a lot of the evidence that goes to support such claims are anecdotal. And so the motivating impetus for our project is to test such conjectures and others about the experience of overseas Chinese students in the US more systematically. To give you an overview, first I'm going to introduce a panel study that we're currently in the midst of conducting. Then I'll talk about a comparison of Chinese students in the US and in China. Third, I'll compare changes in student opinion between the fall of last year, 2019, and the fall of this year. And finally, I'm going to discuss an experiment that Glenn spoke about, that we conducted to examine the effects of anti-Chinese racism on these overseas students. So starting in the fall of 2019, we recruited a cohort of nearly 400 Chinese first-year undergraduate students studying in the U.S. They come from over 66 universities in the U.S., and we call this our U.S. sample. At the same time, in fall of last year, we also recruited a cohort of Chinese first-year undergraduate students studying at three top-tier universities in China, which we call our China sample. We recruited students in both samples using the same criteria. First, they must all be Chinese nationals. Second, they're all born between 1995 and 2002. Third, they're attending a four-year college, and they were in their first year of it last year. And lastly, they completed their high school education in mainland China. So to be clear, everything I'm going to talk about today is focused on undergraduate students. These are students who are 18 and 19 years old as of fall of last year. We recruited the US sample mainly with the help of 10 really amazing research assistants who come from five US universities. These five universities include two private universities, three public institutions. They're located in the Northeast, South, Midwest, and Western parts of the US. And we asked these research assistants to recruit freshmen at their own universities, as well as through their broader personal networks. And I can tell you that among our US sample, slightly more than half of all of our US sample come from these five institutions. Students in the US and China sample are recontacted every 6 months, and we hope to do this until they graduate. This is where we are in our current phase of the study. Our initial phase one baseline was conducted in October of 2019. We did a second wave two follow-up in the spring of this year. And in that spring wave, we asked respondents about COVID and embedded the experiment, which I'll talk about later. We just finished wave three, which is the first year follow-up survey. And as you can see, the recontact rates we've had are pretty high. For the US sample, our wave two recontact rate was 85%, and in wave three, 74%. So first, what do we find when we compare Chinese undergraduates studying in the US against those who are studying at top universities in China? Our sample of US and China-based college students are relatively balanced on gender. Slightly more than half in both samples are women. But that's really where the similarity ends. As this table shows, 97% of the Chinese first-year students in the US grew up in large first-tier cities, but only 57% did in the China sample. A much larger proportion of students who are in the US have college-educated parents, compared to the China sample, as well as parents who hold managerial positions at work. And compared to students in China, students in the US sample are much more likely to come from affluent families. Next, turning to their political attitudes. So this figure shows data from our wave one survey from October 2019. In red, I'm going to show you a couple like this. In red is the distribution of responses from our China sample. In blue is the distribution of responses from our US sample. So keep in mind, these are all Chinese nationals who are undergraduates. And what we see here is that students from the US sample at the beginning of their time in the US are more supportive of liberal political institutions such as free speech and media than students in the China sample. Students in the US sample also have a more positive view of the US than those in China. So for example, students in our US sample are more likely to agree that US foreign policy has played a positive role in world peace and development. Students in the US sample are also less supportive of the political status quo in China than students in the China sample. So for example, they're less likely to agree with the statement that in the long run, China's political system can solve the problems that China faces. Students in the US sample are less nationalistic than students in the China sample. Here, by nationalism, we mean opinions related to nationalistic policies. for example, support for the idea that China's national unity and territorial integrity should be defended at all costs. So we find lower support for statements such as that among students in our US sample. Students in the US sample are also less patriotic. And so by patriotism, we're talking about agreement with statements such as, I feel lucky and proud to be Chinese. And when others criticize China, I feel that they're criticizing myself. However, we find that students in the US sample, when they first arrived in the US in the fall of 2019, were more likely to subscribe to this narrative promoted by the Chinese government of China as a victim that deserves to retake its rightful place in the world order. This is what we call the narrative of victimization and China's rebirth. So for example, students in the US sample were more likely than those in the China sample to agree that if China is not powerful, foreign countries will try to suppress China. We also find that students in the US sample are more supportive of liberal market economy. There are a few other dimensions that we measure, for example, social values, gender equality. We find that on those dimensions, students in the US sample are also more liberal than those in the China sample. I'm not going to go through those with you right now because I want to show you some results from the third wave of our survey, which we just completed. And I'm going to show you a comparison of attitudes between the fall of 2019 and today. In all of these plots, the top figure is from the wave one survey in fall of 2019. The bottom figure contains data from wave three, which we just completed. We've set the wave one China sample to mean zero. So the dashed line in the top figure will always be at zero, that dashed red vertical line. And we've adjusted the US sample from wave one as well as the wave three responses accordingly. As you can see here, there really hasn't been much change over the past year in terms of support for freedom of speech and media. The China sample has remained basically the same. Opinions in the US sample have shifted a bit more towards support for freedom of speech and media, but the changes are not statistically significant. Similarly, we don't see any changes in attitude toward the US. And just keep in mind, obviously a lot has happened in 2020. And so we're comparing attitudes from fall of 2019 to now, and we don't really see much change in these attitudes toward the US. Looking at support for the status quo authoritarian political system in China, there's a small increase in support in the China sample, and the US sample is more consolidated, so that distribution has come together, but there hasn't been any big changes in average attitudes. The place where we do see change is patriotism. So between the fall of 2019 and the fall of 2020, students in the US sample have become less patriotic, so they're less likely to agree with statements such as, when others criticize China, I feel that they're criticizing myself. There's no change in patriotic sentiment among the China sample. The other area where we see changes in attitude relates to this narrative of victimization and rebirth. As you recall, in fall of 2019, students in the US sample were more likely to subscribe to this narrative. But if you look now at the fall of 2020, students in the US sample have moved to the left of the students in the China sample. So students in the US sample are now less likely than the China sample, students in the China sample, to subscribe to this narrative of China's victimization and rebirth. Okay, now moving to this experiment on the effects of anti-Chinese racism. So 2020 has been a year of crises, and crises often impact intergroup and inter-ethnic relations. They can increase exclusionary attitudes toward racial minorities. And we've seen that as a result of the COVID pandemic, anti-Chinese sentiment in the US, which was already on the upswing in the past few years, has really ratcheted up significantly. So we were motivated to truly try to understand what happens when these overseas Chinese students who come to the US experience xenophobic, anti-Chinese, racist rhetoric. And there are a couple of different theoretical ideas that influence answers to this question. On one hand, scholars and policymakers have long thought that the cross-border flow of people for educational exchange can help transfer democratic values. But there's also a really large body of research showing that experiencing discrimination and racism can lead to a retreat from or a backlash against the dominant group. For example, among immigrants, discrimination has been shown to diminish integration and assimilation. Based on this prior research in discrimination, we hypothesized that when Chinese students studying in the US encounter discriminatory attacks tied to their nationality, it may increase their support for the political values associated with that national affiliation. So what that means in our context is that experiencing anti-Chinese racism leads to an increased support for the political values of the Chinese regime, which is authoritarian rule. To test this hypothesis, we conducted an experiment in the US sample during the second wave of our panel study. Respondents began that survey by first answering questions about their family background. Then we asked for their perceptions of how different governments across the world handled COVID. And finally, we asked questions to measure their level of nationalism and political liberalism. So these are the kind of background information and pre-treatment measures of political opinion. Then we randomly assigned students into three groups. All three groups were exposed to criticisms of the Chinese government's handling of COVID. But we varied whether respondents were exposed to criticism from the US media or whether the criticism was racially derogatory. So in the first group, the control group, students read a Chinese news article about the death of Dr. Li Wenliang, who's a Chinese doctor from Wuhan, who was silenced for first speaking out about COVID in the early days and who subsequently died of the disease. Students then read 10 comments collected from Chinese social media that criticized the Chinese government's handling of COVID-19. In the two other groups, treatment A and treatment B, students read a similar article about the death of Dr. Li Wenliang, but written by a mainstream US media outlet. Students in treatment A then read 10 comments we collected from US social media criticizing the Chinese government's handling of COVID. Students in treatment group B also read actual comments from US social media. 5 were critical of the Chinese government, and 5 contained racially derogatory comments blaming Chinese people for the spread of COVID-19. We then asked students in all three groups the same questions to measure their support for China's political system. What we find is that encountering racist rhetoric increases student support for the status quo political institutions in China. In other words, it increases support for authoritarian rule in China and decreases support for political reform in China. So if you look at the figure on the left, you can see that students who read comments critical of the Chinese government from US social media, treatment A, they don't evaluate the suitability of China's political system for China any differently than students who read critical comments from Chinese social media, which is the control group. However, students exposed to racist comments on US social media, treatment B, were more likely to say that despite flaws, China's political system is suitable for China's current situation. If you look at the central figure, you see that when students are asked whether they agree that China's system is not inferior to those of Western democracies, we can see no differences between students randomly assigned to treatment A and those in the control group. But students who are exposed to the xenophobic comments in treatment B are more likely to agree that China's political system is not inferior to Western democracy. And finally, looking at the figure on the right, exposure to racist commentary makes students more likely to agree that nothing in particular about China's political system needs improving. And this increase, we don't see that in treatment A, where the students see critical commentary from US social media. If we look at who's most affected by these racist rhetoric, we find that students who are least supportive of nationalistic policies exhibit the biggest increases in support for Chinese authoritarianism. So on the x-axis of this figure is the level of nationalism of our student respondents. So lower values means they're less nationalistic, higher values means they're more nationalistic. And the y-axis is the marginal effect of treatment B on the control group. We're using kernel estimation with bootstrapped confidence intervals here. So what we see is that the marginal effects of the racist rhetoric are greater for the smaller values on the x-axis of nationalism. Why is this the case, that racist rhetoric seems to have a bigger effect on those who are less nationalistic? It could be because racist comments are more novel to these students who are less nationalistic, or because those who hold strongly nationalistic views are already highly supportive of Beijing. A potential alternative explanation for our results is that they're driven by social comparison rather than racism. So how people evaluate their own countries is often relative to evaluations of other countries. And it could be the case that experiencing racist attacks in the US leads students to evaluate the US more negatively, and by comparison, evaluate China more positively. So social comparison might be particularly important because this experiment took place during the early days of COVID. And we do observe that across all of our sample, the whole sample, all treatment groups, respondents evaluated the Chinese government's handling of COVID much more positively than the US response. So the dark bars in the figures, these figures, show the US sample. And if you look on the figure on the left, it shows that 89% of students in the US sample thought the Chinese government handled COVID very well or well. In contrast, if you look at the plot figure on the right, only 11% of students in the US sample thought the US government handled COVID well or very well. However, if social comparison were at work, remember, we have this experiment, randomized experiment, we should then observe that respondents in treatment B who are exposed to racism should be more likely to criticize the US response to COVID than respondents in treatment A. This is not what we find. Respondents in treatment B are not more likely to criticize the US response to COVID. Instead, really what we observe in treatment B, this exposure to racism, is that respondents are just less likely to criticize and comment on the Chinese government's challenges in handling COVID. And so this suggests that this alternative explanation of social comparison is not a sufficient explanation for the effects of racism that we observe. So to sum up, what have we learned from this panel study? First, the broad brush characterization of Chinese overseas students as nationalistic defenders of China is probably off the mark. Not only are Chinese overseas students in the US less nationalistic and more politically liberal than their peers in China, students in the US who read highly critical comments of the Chinese government, so those in treatment A, do not show more support for China's current political system. So you don't see this backlash. We don't find support for the idea that students in the US, when they face critical comments about the political system of the Chinese government, that they somehow become nationalistic defenders. We don't find support for that. Second, in the time frame, so from fall of 2019 to fall of 2020, we find no evidence that spending time in the US increased Chinese nationalism and decreased support for democratic values. Chinese students in the US remain politically liberal. They remain less nationalistic than their peers in China. And if anything, they're less patriotic now than they were a year ago and less likely to subscribe to this narrative promoted by the Chinese government of China's victimization and rebirth. We find that encountering anti-Chinese racism boosts support for the Chinese regime, and that results do not appear to be explained by relative comparison of US and China handling of COVID-19. Thanks so much for this opportunity to share our results. And we very much look forward to your questions and to the discussion.
Thank you very much, Jen, for that great presentation. I want to prod you and Yi Qing as a start off for our discussion into being a little bit more critical about the liberal proclivities that you ascribe to US-based Chinese students. Given the different socioeconomic backgrounds of the US-based students from those who remain in China, can you say whether the US-based students were already more liberal and less nationalistic and less trusting of the Chinese government before they left China? This would be relevant to the uptake of democratic values by exposure to the United States after they arrive here. It would seem to me anyway that their life experience and schooling would already have been atypical, and the decision of their parents to opt out of the Gaokao, for example, underscores that kind of nonconformity. So in a way, they're coming from relatively privileged backgrounds. They're more likely to feel self-made, resent the impositions of the Chinese state. Maybe the liberal values that you're measuring are actually homegrown, which is in and of itself an interesting phenomenon. And so a further question would be, to what extent might they reflect class or personal self-interest rather than any deeper commitment to liberalism? I'm kind of reminded here of the tragedy, you know, of the student leaders in Tiananmen Square, many of whom preach democracy, but as Liu Xiaobo argued, they really struggled to practice it. So I just put that out there and ask for your reactions to it.
Glenn, you're exactly right that there is, the students who come to the U.S. are very different, and their prior values and opinions might be shaped by their socioeconomic upbringing and their background. So I think that is important. That's very important to know. It's a very important piece of context. Something that we motivated our research was the idea that when students come to the U.S., somehow the U.S. is not what they expected, and then there's a backlash against democratic values. And what we see from at least the first year, from their freshman to sophomore year, is that that doesn't appear to be happening at all.
Well, I think I can add one point. A better way to answer a question is to survey the students prior to their coming to the United States when they're still in high school. We attempt to do that, but it was extremely difficult to do for a couple of different reasons. One is that they're still minors, and so the IRBs will be more difficult. And the other reason is that they're not in the United States. They have not been, so it's easy, it's more difficult to contact them on the basis of schools. So that's the reason we didn't do that. But immediately after they arrived at the United States, we surveyed them in the fall. So I think that you're right. So most of the values are basically they carry their values to the United States instead of forming their opinions 1 month after arriving in the United States.
Right. That's very interesting as an argument about where China's polity is, particularly in the Xi Jinping era. So in light of your remarks about social scientific surveys, one thing jumped out at me. Many foreign scholars report that they're no longer able to conduct such surveys in China owing to the more restrictive political environment in the country. I was wondering if you could comment on your experience conducting those surveys, and for those of us who work on China, how the climate for survey research of this sort has changed compared to several years ago.
I would say the environment has definitely tightened over the past 5 to 8 years. In order to conduct surveys, we collaborate with researchers at Chinese universities, and there are more reviews that need to be, there are more reviews of the types of questions we asked and the types of research we want to do. But I wouldn't say that there's no opportunity or no space to do social science research and social science surveys. It's more of a matter of understanding the local context and definitely having local collaborators who can help navigate that with you.
I also like to add that not only macro environment has changed, but also building a trusting relationship between the surveyor, the research team, and the respondents is very important. We start to see that the students in the United States will question who you are, what's your motive, things like that. So we need to explain to them what the scope of the research, and also having local collaborators in China, our Chinese colleagues in China, is extremely helpful in terms of building this trusting relationship between the researchers and the respondents.
As someone who spends a lot of time looking at Chinese propaganda and information operations, I want to take us down another road. From a certain point of view, your paper has experimentally validated something that political propagandists have long understood, that human psychology is prone to the logic of Manichaean two-line struggles, you know, good, bad, believer, heretic, friend, enemy. And the CCP even has a term for this. It's called clarifying boundaries, but you and I might call it political polarization. In a way, you could say that your experiment hands party propagandists a simple recipe for agitprop, for achieving what a lifetime of censored media and patriotic education could not, for taking a cohort of China's future elite whose support for the party is and the party state is actually soft, and reliably solidifying that. Party propagandists don't even need to author this racist rhetoric themselves. They can just, but they certainly would if it suited them. All they need to do is cherry pick the repugnant utterings of a few Americans and amplify those, right? And they just make sure that this racist rhetoric circulates widely on WeChat so that every young Chinese overseas student encounters it. And then the rest kind of takes care of itself. And so you could apply this to Chinese students in the US, you could apply it to people in Hong Kong. What is your reaction to that? How do we combat it? And what kind of strategies should we adopt to kind of resist that? Does exposure to racist content leave a psychological trace even when the original idea has been shown to have dubious provenance or been debunked or fact-checked? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so first I would say that it has been already a theme in Chinese propaganda. There is a narrative in Chinese propaganda that American democratic society is a racist society. And so I think for future research for us, there's a question of if we were to have redone our experiment among other international students in the US, would we observe the same result? And if we, well, depending on what we find, if we don't observe the same result, then maybe this reaction is because it's somehow building off of that prior propaganda in the US context. In the Chinese context. But that's an empirical question. I think your question is also, how do we combat it? I think there, again, it's probably more information rather than less information, or rather than censoring. So to have discussions about race relations, about what that is like in the US, to have open conversations where these questions and these issues can be brought up and voiced openly and discussed. But I think there's lastly, this question of how prevalent is this in the US? And I think that's something that, you know, that's an empirical fact that changes over time. And I wonder, at least based on of the data that I've seen, whether there has been an increase in the last, especially this year, but in the last 2 years of this type of rhetoric. So it's not that rare. And even without Chinese government propaganda, if students are coming across it more frequently, then I think the remedy there is less about Chinese students and more about US society.
I want to two finger on this. I think an important factor, of course, is the political leadership. The current administration's narrative, that of course doesn't help. But I think I want to point to an interesting and maybe seemingly contradictory phenomenon that our panel study has shown, which is compared with students studying in China, students in the United States after a year of being exposed to this kind of rhetoric in the United States actually feel less victimized than the students in China. I think there are a lot of different forces are in play. So my talking to my students and friends in college, my conjecture is that, first of all, they receive multiple sources of information in the United States. And we should not think of them as people who are, they're fairly sophisticated. Young people, they get pretty good education back in China and now in the United States, and they are able to discern some misinformation and also to tell the people around them who Americans care about. Well, for students in China, their source information is much more controlled. That's one conjecture. I'm actually surprised at this finding. I thought because of my personal experience exposing to the media environment in the United States, I thought the students in China, in the United States would be feeling more victimized than students in China. And also I want to say the finding that we find there less patriotic, I think a better phrase to describe this is their patriotic sentiment is less salient. They're still very patriotic people talking to these young people in the United States. It's just that they're receiving a lot of information. This part of the sentiment is, compared with students in China, is less salient.
Do you have any sense for how persistent the treatment effects that you're measuring are? Could it be that you're only measuring transitory emotional responses, or is there something deeper?
Yeah, so when we did our third wave, if we look at attitudes by treatment group, we don't see an effect anymore. So we don't know how long exactly it lasts, but it didn't last 6 months. So I think this is, to building on Yiting's point, in the US, you're exposed to a lot of different information. There's a really great diversity of media sources. You're interacting with different types of people. That will shape your experience over time. And so even if some of that is perhaps negative, it seems, at least on the whole, that we don't see this kind of reinforcement of Chinese propaganda.
Well, otherwise, we would feel very guilty. Like, that's a terrible thing that we give them a small dosage of information.
Right. It raises ethical questions then too, right? Yeah, exactly. I wonder, based on your findings then, if you have any strategies or rules of thumb for approaching criticism towards the Chinese government and the Chinese regime in a way that avoids making overseas Chinese students feel like they're being disparaged or unfairly targeted. What you think the strategies going forward should be, and the framings that should be avoided, because certainly there are those who are doing it consciously and deliberately, and then there are those who are doing it unconsciously, right? And who would probably be shocked or dismayed to discover that they are pushing buttons that they had not intended to push. So I wonder what your findings suggest in those terms.
Yeah, so what our treatment conditions suggest is that criticisms of the Chinese government, of actions by political leaders, about the institutions, China's institutions, they don't generate any of the kind of backlash effect that we observe. It's mm-hmm. only when there are these comments about the nature of Chinese people or how Chinese people behave as a race or as an ethnic group that leads to the backlash. So I think like criticisms of the party, of the government, of governance institutions, of bureaucracies, of leaders, that does not have the effect that we observe. So in some ways it has a kind of, it leaves a really wide space for engaging in discussions of China's political system, including criticisms of the system itself.
Yeah. In terms of how to combat this type of narrative, I think one of our hypotheses is that socialization engagement between Chinese students and American students and teachers are very important. But we didn't have the chance to test these hypotheses because of COVID. We actually, in the second wave, we wanted to ask a lot of questions on socialization, but they ended up not socializing a lot with their friends. But I think the, again, it's like purely anecdotal evidence. I think talking to those students as teachers is very important. As like school administrators and American professors or Chinese professors, talking to those Chinese students will be extremely important. And they write letters to me saying that, oh, you're showing a care to me, and also my colleagues writing letters to them seem to be very important.
I think that's very consistent with my experience teaching Chinese students as well. I mean, there's a certain set of cultural assumptions about the teacher-student relationship that might be a little bit different in China than in the United States that I think respond very well to American faculty who make the effort to do that kind of outreach. And I think American universities, as you say, I think it's incumbent on them, given that there are 370,000 Chinese students in the United States, to do a better job of integrating them and reaching out to them and making them a part of American campus life and American society. We have a question from one of our audience members, and I wonder if you collected any data based on the ethnic composition of your respondents. For example, are Chinese citizens of Korean, Tibetan, or other minority backgrounds responding differently than Han Chinese?
Our sample is overwhelmingly Han, so we can't make any inferences about non-Han ethnic minorities.
Okay. I want to give Larry Diamond an opportunity to step in and ask a question.
I'll be brief because we have so many interesting questions in this box now that I know Glenn is going to want to keep getting to. I have two questions. One coincides with the question that's been asked about the subject of study. It's been my impression that students who come here as undergraduates to study in the humanities and social sciences may be more liberal and kind of more open to reflection and questioning than students in the science and technology fields. So does subject of study make a difference? And then something that I think it's harder to get at, you know, will require, you know, another layer of examination and survey research, but I think some of the reporting anyway is suggesting could be a factor, is where Chinese overseas students live on a college campus and to what extent they're gathered together and to some extent isolated among themselves, or whether they're interacting robustly with a lot of other students. Some of the big state universities in the U.S. that have large numbers of overseas Chinese students also sometimes have them concentrated living together in a kind of social bubble. And so do you have any evidence of whether that is a relevant variable?
So to the first question, most of the students have not actually declared. I think this is where, because we're focused on undergraduates, maybe what you're talking about with humanities, social sciences versus STEM, that might be more the case for graduate students.
No, I'm talking about undergraduates.
Okay,
too.
So we'll see for undergraduates. They're, most of them are still have not decided what their major is. In some ways, that suggests an openness. If they're not sure whether they're going to do something that's STEM or whether something that's humanities and social science. But that's something that we'll be looking for as we continue the panel study. The second question is also something that we have our eye on. So if it hadn't been for COVID in our second wave, we were actually planning on asking all of these questions about where do they live, who do they live with, who are their closest friends, what are their social interactions like, but because of COVID. And now some of these students are actually back in China. Some are still in the US. That's something we're asking, but hopefully when they come back, that's something we can probe more into.
I wonder if you have any data based on your surveys on the changing climate and discussions in the United States with respect to receptivity to Chinese students, the debates about visa access, the debates about repatriation, about people not being able to study in certain fields, not as relevant to the undergraduate experience, certainly to the graduate student experience, but nonetheless, they're exposed to these discussions, to the sense that Chinese students may no longer be as welcome in the United States as they once were, that they represent a threat to the United States. Is there any reflection of that in your data? Did you give students an opportunity to do open-ended responses also?
Yeah, so that's in wave three. We actually ask a lot of open-ended responses about their thoughts of U.S. society, U.S. political system, China's political system. Because we just closed the survey last week, we haven't had the chance to really analyze those open-ended responses. But one thing we do ask is, you know, of these sophomores who are in our panel, where they are currently. Are they in China? Are they in the U.S.? And whether they plan to come back to the U.S. Because that would be a really big signal if they originally intended to come to the U.S. for education, but somehow because of COVID and other things, they decide to complete their education in China. So that's something that we've collected data on, but we haven't analyzed yet.
Not to answer, but try to give some comments to Lara's question. We don't have good evidence on the effect or the association between major and preferences or attitudes, but we do have some anecdotal stories about from like our RAs collecting data from certain public institutions where a lot of Chinese students reside. Is a little bit more difficult, not only because the personal relationship, the group is so large, it's a little bit difficult to individually reach out to them. Another reason is that there seem to be some students who are suspicious about our motives, maybe because of the lack of socialization between Chinese and American students when there are a lot of Chinese students live together. So it's a possibility. So we actually really want to reach out to them and to ask them about their opinions.
Right.
Also, our sample is a little bit undersampled. Just for these institutions, a little bit undersampled. We have a public institution in the Midwest. We have several public institutions in California, but I think we are still undersampling a typical public institution in the United States.
Yeah, that raises a question that I had with respect to the representativeness of the samples. You say, for example, that your Chinese schools were three top-tier Chinese schools, right? And the suggestion is in the United States, if I read you implicitly correctly, you're also looking at fairly elite institutions. Now, is the experience of Chinese students in those institutions representative, perhaps, of those who are going to less prestigious American universities? Does the socioeconomic profile of the student look different if you go to the smaller state schools or the less prestigious American schools? And then would your data look different, do you think? Do you have any effort to go to that level?
It's funny because when we started this panel in fall of last year, we intended it to be a pilot so we can learn how to do it on a larger scale. Now that we've done it and realize how much effort it takes to maintain a panel, we're like, oh, can we actually expand this and do it larger? But that was always a thought. However, I think it's motivated by exactly what you're suggesting, which is that if we have a larger sample that goes to a more diverse array of schools, maybe the answers would be different. But I think one thing that we never intended was to go beyond four-year colleges. So there are also Chinese students who are at community colleges, and they might look very different in terms of their political opinions. But that wasn't kind of the intended. That wasn't the intended sort of pool. We're trying to look at young people who are likely in the future to take more leadership roles, whether in politics or in business in China. So that's kind of the intended pool that we are aiming for.
Did you ask your U.S.-based Chinese students whether they are active in Chinese students and scholars associations or not, their level of engagement with the Chinese student community in the United States? You know, it has been suggested, for example, that CSSAs play a very important role in managing public opinion and the behavior and activities of Chinese students on American campuses, and that they represent a restraint, perhaps the long arm of the Chinese state on an American university campus. So I was just curious if you have any data on that.
So that was one of the things we were hoping to ask along with their social. That was one of the kind of social questions that we were hoping to ask. One thing I will say, though, is that in the experience of trying to reach these students, we realized that on campuses, especially those that have a lot of Chinese students, there's actually a huge proliferation of Chinese student associations. Yeah. And the reality is, as an undergrad, you're getting bombarded with emails from a million different student organizations. And maybe actually seven of those are somehow China related. And so that's a kind of tangential, indirect way of answering your question, but it doesn't seem like in most of the places where we've interacted with our students that CSAs have like a dominant influence or control over at least the inboxes of the students in our sample.
Right.
Normally,
go ahead.
Normally, the association of getting the best Chinese food is the most popular. I'm half joking, but it's not the. See, I think that this concerns the CSA's influence. So first of all, whether or not they have influence, I cannot say they have not. But these are operated by students as well. They have their own things to care about. And another thing is that these are like 18, 19 year old young people. They have a lot of interests.
Do you get any sense, perhaps more broadly in your conversations with the students or your exposure to the students, of the extent of United Front activity on campuses or in university life? It's also been alleged that the Chinese embassy plays a role or Chinese consulates play a role there in managing student opinion, in making sure that dissent or free thinking is relatively constrained. And many Chinese students on American campuses do feel like they are being watched, and they do have to be careful about what they say in lectures. Naturally, there's the concern about courses on Zoom in the last year as well. So I'm just curious if you see reflections of that in your data.
Well, it's my personal conjecture. There's no evidence. I think it's less about, I think the Chinese student sentiment or nationalistic sentiment or the attitude toward support for or authoritarian system or political status quo is more influenced by the media and information that received from different media sources. Some of them, of course, it's China-based and is propaganda, but also American media sources. But it's less about being managed by certain entities in the United States. I think if you just think about it, how to manage opinions of college students, it's a difficult task, even if you want to do that. But those propaganda efforts using new media format is definitely out there. And I think Chen also doing research on that. That's my personal conjecture. So it's just if you are an autocrat, you have a toolkit. What is your most effective tool you want to use to influence people in a large scale? So I would not say that it's like micromanage opinion on college campus is the most effective tool.
Yeah, what I would say, it's not an answer to your question because we really don't have data that speaks to your question, is that in our U.S. survey, there are some questions that we ask that we cannot include in the China version of the survey, especially some questions around political institutions. But what we find, and there's some open-ended questions, especially in the last wave, that we ask that we could not ask in our China sample. But what we find is that the students in the U.S. are answering those questions, and they're doing it in a very thoughtful and reflective way. So at least in this setting where their anonymity is protected, they are, some portion of them are, feel like they can respond. So I think that's where this idea that this micromanagement of opinion, of thinking, there are definitely limits to that, especially for students who are in the US, who are receiving an education in this context.
It has been suggested by some people that one of the things that American universities could do to better expose overseas students, not just Chinese students, but from all over the world, to American values and communicate the democratic ideals that we sometimes struggle to live up to, is by reinstituting some version of a core curriculum that exposes them to great ideas or great books or great thinkers in the American tradition. So that they can see the debates, the struggles that America has had trying to define and live up to our own ideals firsthand, and not have it presented to them in the bowdlerized ways that the Chinese media sometimes does, and American media can as well. Do you have any reaction to that proposal? Do you think that we should do better at exposing our overseas students and integrating them into American life by presenting them with this kind of structured introduction?
We might have an answer for you in a year. Because I think that's something where we, in each survey, we ask the students for information about their courses so that we can analyze how maybe the difference in their courses, as well as major influence, if it has any influence on their political opinion. We've also thought about doing something more experimentally to expose students to this type of content to see if it has an effect. So these are all things that we've been thinking about but don't have an answer on yet.
Right. A lot of my questions are phrased that way, which then leads me to ask you in closing, what is the ultimate goal of this project? Is there going to be a book, a series of articles? What should we be looking for? Because it looks like there's so many interesting areas that you're beginning to tap into, things that we're thirsty for knowledge about. So where should we look?
I think we'll be writing papers. And if we there'll be papers. Okay. Hopefully we can sustain this panel.
I would say we shouldn't overlook the amount of challenge that we're going to face. This is just a pilot. Originally, we already face a lot of challenges in terms of keeping contact with those students. The recount has already dropped. 30% of people are no longer responding to our emails. So we add a little bit more, a few more people, to close to 200 more students into our pool. Whether or not we can expand this sample during the pandemic is another question that we're still thinking. So I think there's a lot of challenges, but we are certainly very committed to studying opinions and attitudes of this very important subpopulation, the future leaders of China, both students in China and students studying in the United States.
It's super important work that you're doing, and we're incredibly supportive of it. We look forward to the work that you generate too, because these issues are not going away, particularly as we redefine our relationship with China. And so we need to get them right and need to understand also how we might inadvertently be producing the unintended consequences as we struggle to redefine our relationship with China. I want to thank you both for joining us. I wish you the best with this work. It's excellent. Look forward to future conversations. Mm-hmm.